Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to attack Syria and Iran, so he visits Moscow. But while he's there, a new Russian fleet sails into the Mediterranean. So Netanyahu gets a cool response from the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And 3 weeks to go until the not-so-secret-as-they-used-to-be NATO Mafia Bilderberg Club conference. They have their annual conference in Britain this year. The protest festival outside is already being organised. Bilderberg don't appear on any of our university curriculums, at least not to my knowledge, but they control almost all of the money in the Western world. They were founded by a Nazi SS officer. So what's the latest on Bilderberg's links to fascism, war and organised crime? Meanwhile, doing something about Bristol First Bus's stranglehold virtually on our need to get to and from work every day. Many say it feels like a racket, but same can suburban Bristol Railways and bus rapid transit do the trick. Judy Boston joins us, and she's been one of the prime movers in public transport in Bristol, trying to help get and succeeding getting more frequent services on the Severn Beach line. Martin Summers is going to begin, though, by taking us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Where would you like to start this week, Martin?
Well, where would you
like to start? I gave you a clue with the meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu
the Eastern
and
Mediterranean,
Vladimir Putin.
Then. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Netanyahu has gone to talk to Putin to try and clear what he wants to do, i.e. intervene in Syria and possibly attack Iran. And Putin has responded by stonewalling and sending a fleet into the Mediterranean. I mean, and also supplying anti-ship missiles to the Syrians.
So this is a little bit cheeky, isn't it? Netanyahu wants to come to Moscow, I imagine, to sort of try and sort out the security situation. But while he's there, various things are going on, which are actually possibly making things worse. Putin is really almost taking the mickey.
Well, no, what's happening is that you've got Russian personnel working on these anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles inside Syria. And I presume what Putin has told Netanyahu is, if you attack our personnel, we will attack you. I mean, that's how serious this is all becoming.
OK, we've also got a conference going on over the weekend at the Malcolm X Centre. Soft Drug Legalisation, it's called. The NORML Conference. That's tomorrow and Sunday at the Malcolm X Centre. Entry price is £40 standard for the 2 days and £20 for concessions. Mr Nice, a.k.a. Howard Marks, will be opening the event. That's the Malcolm X Centre, which is in St Paul's. Also, one of the speakers, Martin, is this former MI5 officer, Annie Machon. Tell us a bit about her.
Well, she's a former MI5 officer. In this particular case, she's campaigning for legalisation of soft drugs. But of course, we've also got Transform based in Bristol, and based in central Bristol. People can look them up on the internet. And
well, they'll be there tomorrow, yes.
Yeah, well, they're campaigning for the legalisation of all drugs. And of course, this is actually, when you think about it, there was a UN report on drugs and crime that came out in 2009 from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which pointed out that all of the banking system had basically been rescued by the drug cartels. So when we're talking about, we're going to keep drugs illegal, well, that's the money from illegal drugs is what's keeping the banking system afloat. Now, at this point, it all gets rather silly, doesn't it? HSBC were caught out money laundering for the drug cartels a few months ago, and they've been let off with a slap on the wrist. Meanwhile, we're still arresting teenagers for smoking a joint. It's ridiculous.
Another person who's going to be there this time on Sunday at Malcolm X is Rowan Bosworth Davis, who was on this programme about a month ago. He's a former Fraud Squad officer who's going to be talking, I would imagine, about forensic money laundering experts. So he'll be talking about the money laundering aspect of this. Now, we know that some of the big high street banks have been money laundering, HSBC in Mexico, for example. Still, well, but the HSBC business has been very well proven by the American authorities. In fact, they are, pursuing prosecutions. But still, it seems none of these top bankers go to jail. They still walk around scot-free.
Well, yes, and of course the Latin American politicians, senior politicians all over Latin America are screaming from the rooftops, look, we have just got to legalise drugs.
But isn't it like a bit like a banana republic, where there's a few kind of cosy elite that just do what they want, break the law day after day after day? I mean, what's happened to the judicial system and the policing where these people are just simply not prosecuted?
Well, it's what they call in Latin America impunidad, impunity. And human rights are often abused, not by people being, you know, sent to prison by a court. What happens is they get murdered by somebody, and the people who murder them don't get caught because they're working for the government or the drug cartels or both of them. And that's pretty common all over Latin America. I mean, in Colombia, for example, which I know quite a bit about, the Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, the AUCs, the right-wing paramilitaries, funded by drug trafficking, with a wink and a nod from the CIA, as long as they keep on killing trade unionists and other opponents of the regime. And this is going on all over the world, and in Latin America people just regard this as an absolute joke. The drugs being illegal just creates the opportunity for intelligence services like the CIA to engage in all kinds of skullduggery with slush funds which are generated from the drugs trade.
And another person who's going to be at the conference at the Malcolm X over the weekend is the former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire, Tom Lloyd.
Well, I presume he's in favour of legalisation, that's why he's there, yeah.
Annie Machon, though, let's talk about her a little bit more. It'd be interesting. We'll see if we can go down and have a chat with her tomorrow as well, because she was also involved in the UK 9/11 truth movement, and as such was removed from some panel, I believe, the United Nations discussion panel, due to B'nai B'rith lobbying. Now, what is B'nai B'rith?
Well, there
is an Israeli organisation.
Well, they're not an Israeli organisation. No? They're based in the US, but they're a sort of... they're very close to the Israeli government, let's put it that way. They're pro-Israel, strongly pro-Israel, and they lobbied for her to be removed from this UN panel because of her position, A, on 9/11, but also, which, you know, Annie's position is that the US government that carried out 9/11. One wonders why the Israelis feel that they have to pipe up. The other reason why, of course, they're opposed to her is because she blew the whistle on the fact that the Israelis probably bombed their own embassy here in Britain as a means of trying to gain sympathy for themselves, and, of course, Palestinians were fitted
up. Just hang on a minute. Why would the Israelis bomb their own embassy?
Because they want to be seen to be the victims. And don't forget that Annie was part of MI5 when all of this happened, and she's got inside knowledge. And in fact, there's a couple of Palestinian activists who were sent to prison for that bombing, and Annie's position is that those guys are innocent and that the Israelis themselves, in fact, carried out the
bombing. And what does she base that on?
Based on the fact that she was an MI5 working on the case at the time.
Okay, moves that could destabilise the situation in Syria must be avoided. This is Putin again, but I mean, ultimately, Martin, this is his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu. What is going to happen with Syria? Because we keep being told again and again there's going to be no acceptance of Assad continuing. David Cameron doesn't want him to continue as president. So what's going to happen? It seems like this is the real pinch point on the way to possibly an attack on Iran and war in the Middle East. Some really serious conflict. It's already going on in Syria. But I mean, what can happen? And what do you think is the situation there on the ground right now? I mean, for example, last week we had some of the Syrian rebels capturing some UN peacekeepers.
And there was also a bomb attack inside Turkey just drove the border from Syria, blamed by the Turkish government on the Syrian intelligence services, blamed by the Syrians on the Turkish intelligence services. And of course the Turkish intelligence services have got a track record of blowing things up and blaming it on different people, just as our own intelligence services have. They're part of NATO.
It seems a lot of this is about when there's a bomb attack of some kind or some atrocity, how do we know who's caused it? I mean, is it just I almost feel like, well, if the press are telling us one thing, then it's probably the opposite.
Well, the fact is, we shouldn't jump to judgment when any of these terrible events happen. But of course, car bombs are 10 a penny in Iraq and Syria, and Turkey's just had one of its own. Of course, they've got a huge conflict with the Kurds, which has been going on for a long time. There's some kind of peace negotiation going on around that. The real danger is that Syria, you know, the tremendous suffering that's going on in Syria, whoever's to blame, is going to spread to Turkey, to Jordan, to Lebanon, to Iraq, and, of course, into Israel as well. And so the whole thing is on the edge of chaos.
Well, we had a US writer on this show the other day, Chris Bolin, talking about Terry Gilliam's film Brazil, where in that society, a sort of dystopia in the future, bombs are just going off willy-nilly here, there and everywhere. But actually, that is what it's like now in places like Iraq and Syria.
It is, yes, and of course we have, there's virtually as many people being killed in Iraq day by day as in Syria, but of course that's, we don't want to talk about that.
I wonder
the same Sunni insurgents which are blowing up Shia mosques in Iraq are part of the same organisations which are blowing up Alawite mosques in Syria, and in the West is treating them in Iraq as terrorists and treating them in Syria as freedom fighters, but it's the same people.
I wonder if ordinary Iraqis are just praying for the days when Saddam was in charge to come back.
Well, I think it's very easy for us to sit in here and say what people in Syria or Iraq are thinking. I think people are suffering, of that we can be sure. And of course, what's happening all over the world is that as the economy crashes, and don't forget the places like Iraq and Syria were relatively prosperous, stable places before all this started, the situation is just getting worse and worse for ordinary people.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And a big scandal in... This is almost like something from James Bond, isn't it? Promises of millions, a new face and detailed instructions on a double-agent conspiracy in Moscow, bearing the hallmarks of a Cold War spy thriller. Russia's counterintelligence agency has caught a CIA officer trying to flip a Russian operative. We are ready to offer you $100,000 to discuss your experience and cooperation. Also offering people $1 million a year payment if they come over to work for the American intelligence.
Well, yes, they're just...
And this is a note that they found on this guy.
Well, what we've actually got is the regime in Russia is digging its heels in. They've just sent a naval task force into the Eastern Mediterranean. They've supplied the Syrians with anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles, the sort of missiles that kill aircraft carriers. And what Putin is saying, without shouting and screaming, is... Don't go any further, because you will cross a red line, and then you will be fighting with us. And don't forget that our missiles kill aircraft carriers. The US has got about 30-odd aircraft carriers. They've got a lot more than anybody else. The Russians have got 2. The Chinese have got 1. But what the Chinese and the Russians have got, and they're going to give it to the Iranians and the Syrians, they've already passed them the stuff to them, is things that kill aircraft carriers. Now, just think, if we go to war with Syria, if Britain's 1 aircraft carrier is sunk in the Gulf, that will be everybody on that aircraft carrier will die, without doubt. So that'll be several tens of thousands of British sailors will die. That's where we're at.
Well, one of the reasons for that might be that the Americans do already think that they rule the world. This is this little map, Martin. This is in, I've just printed out a copy of it here, which is looking at the entire world divided up into US Northcom, that's North America, US PACOM, which is in the Pacific, US Southcom, which is South America, US AFRICOM, which is Africa, US CENTCOM, which is the Middle East, US EUCOM, which is us, and Russia, and then USPACOM, which is Australasia and India and China. But, I mean, it's a little bit arrogant of them to be putting maps out like this, Martin, isn't it, where actually every part of the world comes under their command.
Well, indeed, it's what they call full spectrum dominance, isn't it? I mean, the US has got hundreds of bases around the world, quite a few in this country. Now, you say, a country that just wants to mind its own business, why have you got bases everywhere? And that's because they want to rule everywhere. But, of course, other gangsters in China and Russia are not happy to allow the East Side to be taken over by Al Capone, so there's going to be some shooting, isn't there?
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, good that you raised that, Martin, because the grandson of Malcolm X, Malcolm Shabazz, has died in suspicious circumstances. And this is from Amsterdam headlines. Malcolm Shabazz, a grandson of Malcolm X, is killed. Shabazz was Malcolm X's grandson. On February the 21st, 1965, Malcolm was killed as he was about to speak in Manhattan. In his autobiography, he commented on his possible death, saying, "Every morning when I wake now, I regard it as having another borrowed day. In any city, wherever I go, making speeches, holding meetings, or attending to other business, black men are watching every move I make, awaiting their chance to kill me. And I've said publicly many times, I know they have their orders. Anyone who chooses not to believe what I'm saying doesn't know the Muslims in the Nation of Islam. I know too that I could suddenly die at the hands of some white racist, or I could die at the hands of a Negro hired by the white man, or it could be some brainwashed Negro acting on his own idea that by eliminating me he would be helping out the white man, because I talk about the white man the way I do." But now his grandson is dead too, in suspicious circumstances,
in
Martin.
Mexico.
Died in Mexico show. Also, he'd been being harassed and hassled by the FBI for quite a long time. But, I mean, many people, or some people anyway, are saying that it's that it could have been just an accident, that this guy just didn't like him, attacked him and killed him.
Well, there is a track record of the US intelligence services, the FBI and others, of assassinating political opponents. I mean, Martin Luther King's family have had a day in court in the US recently, in the last couple of years, where they've brought a civil action against the US government, and with it, and they had a jury in the courtroom, and the jury concluded that the state indeed was responsible for the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, in actual fact, what we're dealing with in the United States is an illegitimate gangster government that murders its political opponents, which is why Putin looks them in the eye and says, "And you're going to accuse us of not having any human rights in Russia? Don't make me laugh."
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Finally, in our international section, Greece is trying to kill its biggest anti-government website and radio stations. The Athens branch of Indie Media, an independent open network of journalists who report on political and social issues, was shut down last Thursday. Before its plug was pulled, the site was used for such principal purposes as reporting on cases of police brutality and expressing underground dealings between the Greek police force and the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party. If you've somehow managed not to come across it before, it's a kind of localised WikiLeaks, only without that tricky stigma that comes with rape allegations and overstaying your welcome at South American embassies. You might also remember the case of 15-year-old Alexander Grigoropoulos, whose death in 2008 at the hands of a Greek police officer spurred the riots that plunged Athens into apocalyptic tumult for almost a month. Indie Media helped to uncover the details of that shooting and played a large part in helping demonstrators mobilise and communicate in the riots that followed. Golden Dawn and the police. Indie Media is exposing it, Martin, and now they're being closed down.
Yeah, well, don't forget there was a military coup in Greece in the 1960s, backed by the British and the Americans, in which thousands of people were tortured to death by the Greek army with the support of NATO. And, of course, people in Greece remember that. They also remember, of course, in the Second World War, they were occupied by Angela Merkel's country, Germany. And, you know, basically, democracy, even in the country which thought of the idea of democracy, is an incredibly fragile thing.
And what about, many people here looking at Spain, looking at Greece, looking at Italy, and wondering how long until that kind of chaos comes here? I mean, the lack of jobs, the real, you know, basically just completely running out of money. How long until that's coming here?
Well, I think we're coming to an inflection point in the crisis. What people don't seem to realise is that the euro crisis isn't about the euro, it's about the banking system.
And yeah, but the bankers are winning. They're slowly but surely winning. Well, all the time they're winning, they are not going to allow themselves to collapse, are they?
Well, no, because they can't help. But the point is that they control the collapse and the follow-on. But they know there's going to be a collapse,
the debt,
and they're ready
for it. You look at the debt in America, right? You've got trillions and trillions of debt. It's going up all the time. In fact, there's a little debt clock online.
Yeah,
the banks can continue to produce money, continue to extend loans. It's a bit like the loan shark can keep coming back.
Well, in Japan, they've just decided to have a massive stimulus package with the new right-wing government in Japan. But, of course, it's not working because it's actually forcing up the interest rate on their bonds. Now, there's so many different ways in which a crash could happen here that I think I'm absolutely on solid ground by saying that there will be a crash at some point. If a country the size of Cyprus hadn't been fixed properly, that could have been the triggering point. And there's basically lots of Cypresses out there, and at some point there is going to be a crash, which is what makes all this argument in or out of the EU so irrelevant. The banking system is about to go down the tubes, just like in Argentina in the 2000s, and then people will not be worried about whether they're in or out of the EU. They'll be wondering whether they can get any money out of the bank at all and what they're going to eat tomorrow.
And one of the main things that's been going on in the Middle East this week, and we're talking also about Pakistan as well, is mosque bombings. This is really worrying, isn't it? Yeah. Because it seems that who is planting these? Again, we come back to this question: who is planting these bombs? Because it is quite feasible for someone to be orchestrating this Shia versus Sunni thing, making it look as if these communities are fighting each other. We had in the Second World War, we had synagogues being attacked, synagogues being bombed. Now it's mosques.
Yes, and of course what's really, the whole Sunni versus Shia thing is being pushed by the neocons in the West and by the Israeli right wing, because having the Shias kill the Sunnis and the Sunnis kill the Shias saves us the bother. But of course the whole game is to control oil, resources, territory.
Is it fair to relate some of this to the Protestants versus the Catholics in Northern Ireland? Because there was
every conflict has got a specific history, and there are specific reasons why people don't like each other or feel difficult to get on. I mean, I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia. It seemed to be complicated enough before I got there, and when I got there, I realised it's even more complicated than that. I mean, what you've got is people using chaos as a means of extending their power and their influence. So the Israeli state, for example, has got a vested interest in seeing Iraq and Syria in turmoil. They are rubbing their hands going, good, that's what we want to see. And they're actually helping to make sure that that happens.
So how does this operate, and who's behind it?
Well, we don't know. An individual attack could be anything. Could be anybody.
But it's a pattern, isn't there?
Yeah, well,
literally yesterday, 48 people killed in an Iraq bombing in Bakbar yesterday, for example.
Yes, well, I mean, basically...
It's day after day now.
I'll just give a copper's hunch here. What people have got to realise is the Al-Qaeda groups which are out there doing most of these kind of attacks on civilians are, in fact, being indirectly orchestrated by Western intelligence services. This is what the Russians are saying. And they, of course, have their means of finding this stuff out. Now, basically, we are dealing with intelligence services in the West and in Russia and in Israel, which are way out of control, way beyond the law, and they should, in fact, be prosecuted by the civilian police force, basically. That's who should be dealing with it. But if the civilian police force don't step forward and deal with these people as they should be dealt with, then, of course, we're all going to war.
Well, one of the examples of that, of course, was the MI6 being in Finsbury Park Mosque, whatever it was, yeah, about 7 or 8 years ago, before the 2005 bombings. And they were the ordinary Muslims in the mosque were reporting, as we always encourage people to do, to the police, these rather strange Muslims that turned, yeah, up and seemed to want to start wars and things. I'm thinking it's Abu Hamza was one of them, I believe, and also Haroon Aswat was one of,
yeah,
them. And yet, when the police then passed this up to the security services to do something about it, nothing happened.
Well, the police have got to stop listening to the security services and start treating them as suspects. Like the police service of Northern Ireland has been set up, it's not the IUC, it's not MI5. And if things go wrong, they should be on that case.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, on to lighter and more local things, and I'm joined by Judy Boston now. Thanks for sitting there patiently, Judy, through that, from Friends of Suburban Bristol Railways. Judy, can you just give us an introduction to how you decided to start campaigning as a railway campaigner? What brought you to it?
Well, around about 95, we were told that Avon County couldn't afford to send the local train that trundled along from Temple Meath to Severn Beach. It couldn't do the Avon Mouth to Severn Beach bit. And I have been around long enough to know the first cut is not, you know, the only cut, you know. And so I managed to connect with a 24-year-old ex-motorist through the cycling campaign, and we did a stunt which was covered by the Post, which they've done ever since with a camera crew and everything. And what we did, we arrived at Avonmouth station around about 7:30 in the morning with a buggy, somebody with a white stick, you know, who was visually impaired, and a trolley and things like that, to make the point that a train will carry those sort of customers, but the bus can't.
Okay, so that was the beginning, and I guess you've seen it sort of the service on that particular line slowly go down and down. But recently, you know, it's had a bit of a revival. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, yes, it did have a lot of cancellations because the council was subsidising one train, and then in 2006, a young, very bright young woman who lived in Montpellier and worked in Shirehampton was a little bit frustrated with the unreliable trains and also the frequency, which was roughly an hour. And she looked on the council website and saw there was a consultation, and the council, which was Lib Dem at that time, said, you know, we've got £4 million, how would you like us to spend it? So she devoted 2 days a week to 4 months to investigating what it would cost to hire, well, first of all, two trains, because we wanted a half-hour service, but realised that was too expensive, so the one train. And then got to work with involving the people of Bristol, showing that they wanted an extra train. And we printed 3,000 postcards and 3,000 leaflets explaining. And people went to the trouble of buying a stamp and putting the postcard on the post. I sent it to the council, and we did have... they eventually, even though the Lib Dems said that was terribly irrelevant... Not irrelevant, irresponsible. but anyway, we got the council to commit for 3 years, because that's what First Group said, we're going to have it for 3 years. And then, of course, the very articulate young woman left Bristol and virtually left me to battle, because, of course, First Group hadn't got much intention of doing it. But fortunately, I think the person who saved it was Councillor Mark Bradshaw, who went on and on and saying, you know, this is a council commitment for 3 years. And First Group, that was something like 18 months after the vote, agreed to start the service, which was in May 2008, and that's why this morning we had a big rally at Stapleton Road Station, and our first point was 1 million passengers, you know, telling the council, telling the politicians what everybody in the country knows, that something that's reliable and frequent and affordable will be used.
So that's a million passengers this year.
And that's the paying passengers. And as somebody said, if they counted the, if they, you know, if everybody paid, it would be 2 million.
I mean, I've come across some public transport providers that when they don't actually want to run a service because it's not bringing in high profit margins, and actually a lot of this is about margins, it's not about whether it actually pays for itself, is it doesn't actually pay enough, is that what they'll do is they'll just stop collecting tickets. I mean, I can remember this back when I was living in London, when they were trying to wind down a bus service. You get on the bus and the bus driver says, it's all right, you don't have to have a ticket, just get on the train. And this was a way of bringing down the passenger numbers. But anyway, it seems like it's a bit of a different story on the Severn Beach line. So now, how frequent is it? And just for those that have never used it, Julie, whereabouts does it run? Which stations?
Well, it runs through Temple Meads, Lawrence Hill, Stapleton Road, Montpellier, Redland, Clifton Down, Seamills, Shirehampton, Avonmouth, and then some trains go on to Severn Beach. They have a two-hourly service, which is unfortunate, not more than unfortunate, just pretty horrendous, I would say. And what they used to have was a bus, but South Gloucester refused to pay from 2008 for the bus. Which was, you know, something little like 30,000 or something a year. So they have like this kind of quite frightening two-hourly service, but it's well used.
Okay, and it is a suburban railway. It's a commuter route for many people, and I think particularly because it goes through Clifton Down as well, you know, which is another big employment area around there, what with the university very close by and a lot of parts of the university. So how frequent is it?
Well, it's about 40 minutes, and that's why I go around, well, our group, and we have got a lot of hard-working people, one of the group gives out 10,000 timetables every year, going to libraries, shops, and so on. But I want to go back to your point that the Severn Beach line's different. No, it's not. No branch lines ever make a profit. In Europe, they are funded by the state, and in England, the intercity trains, when it was under British Rail, made a profit, and the profit was then spent on suburban services or you know, whatever you call them. You might call them rural services, but they're not, you know, there are many non-profitable services. And it's absolutely crucial, as part of any rail network, to have local services to feed in to the main line. If you ever get on the train, if you can afford it, you will see every station has got the most, well, main line stations have got the most enormous car parks. I mean, how ridiculous is that? They should have proper bus services taking people to stations.
I mean, I would compare it to, say, the telephone service. I mean, if you're living out on a Scottish island in the middle of nowhere and you want a telephone, well, you may get in a kind of commercial market world. The phone company may come to you and say, well, that'll be £20,000 for us to install a phone line to your house because you're on an island. Whereas if you're in a city, it's going to cost whatever, a pound or nothing even. And so we're trying to apply, I suppose, the same sort of principle to the railways, where it's a one network, and so the high profit margin parts of that network subsidise the lower margin. What about other...
I'm not sure what you're saying. That happened when it was publicly owned. That doesn't happen now. And the whole railway system is run by two major international bus companies, and their profits... It's something like 16% for bus and 6% for rail. So which one do they want to support? Obviously the bus. And what's the other thing I was going to say?
Point I'm trying to make is that the railway network only works where the high use parts of it, that is to say, for example, coming to London to Bristol, lots and lots of people are using that, cross subsidises onto the smaller parts of the network. And that's what was really destroyed back in the 1960s with the beaching cuts. Now, Martin, I'd just like to...
Sorry, it wasn't. It was when it was privatised in 1995 that section was destroyed. I'm not quite sure.
Well, no, I mean,
what you're talking about it. When it was publicly
owned. Okay. Let me make myself clear. 1963, mm-hmm. 50 years ago, Richard Beeching, who was appointed by the government, looked at the entire railway network of the entire. In fact, it was probably one of the most, if not from possibly Germany was. This was the most comprehensive railway networks in the world. Obviously, the railway started here. And at which point, he looked at the lower profit margin parts of the network and cut them off. And he kept the higher profit margin parts of the network in order to sort of get it into the stage where it was making more money, and then they could, sack people. And it could be begun the process of turning it into a profit-making exercise rather than a public service. And then, I mean, there's a separate thing which happened in the early 90s under John Major, which was the privatisation of that. So, in a way, Beeching was sort of setting the rules for that.
Well, partly Beeching was, but there... You know, you have to look at things in different ways. There's an organisation we belong to called Rail Future, and they wanted to celebrate 50 years from Beeching. And our group said, it's got to be positive. We do not want to spend our time moaning. And we did a little bit of research, and we found that 350 railway stations have been built since the Beeching times. The Bark 87...
Is that rebuilt?
So it's a mixture. Like the various parkways would be brand new. But the point is, and it's a point that needs to be made in these difficult times, is that every single one was paid for by public money or the... in the case of the train that we were talking about, so they used to go to Severn Beach, of course it was a lie, nothing to do with Shorter Munch. They wanted to take the military to Abbey Wood, Filton Abbey Wood, to do whatever happens at Filton Abbey Wood. So the military or whoever paid for that station, Filton Abbey Wood. That was just one. Parkway is a new station. Tilverton Parkway, you know, Yate was rebuilt, I think.
So there has been quite a lot of investment in
exactly,
the railways.
Exactly, and
saying.
They don't want us to know that. They don't want us ever, ever to have any good news. And that's what we celebrated. We made a film. About it. We got a local Bristol filmmaker, and we hope it's going to be on YouTube. We had people who came from Dawlish. We had a representative from Scotland who is based in Bath, but really supportive, and from Melksham. You know, so we had an enormous celebration, and we found it really positive.
Okay, what about the line to Portishead? This is another bugbear, because that could be. I mean, Portishead is actually really on the up at the moment. If you've been there recently, massive marinas, big developments, lots of houses going up, new houses on what I think was possibly floodland that's been reclaimed. Well, so I probably wouldn't myself take a ground floor flat there, but it seems to be all on the up, Portishead. Why haven't we got a train there yet?
Portishead is on the way up, and if you actually read the Bristol Post, you will know that we've been calling for four tracks between Bristol Temple Meads and Filton Abbey Wood, and we had an event there this morning which was attended by Charlotte Leslie, an MP, and several councillors. So four tracks is necessary, electrification is necessary, and then Portishead is part of that.
So why is that? Why do you have to have something at Abbey Wood in order to get on a train at Temple Meads and go to Portishead?
Well, the military were paying. You don't call it the military. I can't remember what you call it. But Abbey Wood, what was it called?
Ministry of Defence.
The Ministry of Defence, exactly. Wanted it. There is. I mean, I think, in my opinion, Bristol very seriously lacks political. What is it? Political will, and it's got to be public money. I mean. Okay, we had about five councillors today, but we emailed all the MPs because the four tracking and the electrification will transform the whole of the South West. You know, it's absolutely crucial. Network Rail has put in the bridge at Stapleton Road where we celebrated. If you look, you buy your Bristol Post on Monday morning, you'll see pictures of us.
Or you look at it for free online.
No, no, no. No way. This is one of our battles, is to get people to buy the Bristol Post. And I think...
Well, it's one of our battles to get them to look at it online.
Well, it might be, but I think there would have been... I think our campaign would have died many years ago. And of course, let's face it, the Bristol Post has got its finger on the pulse. The bus is another issue. They used to sell more when they had bus complaints on the front page. And as an example of their continued commitment, they published some little coupons in last week, about three times, for people to fill in why they wanted four tracks, and to be sent to the Post, and then the Post sent them to me, and they're going off to the Minister of Transport. And in just over a week, almost 100 people have sent them in. Now, can you think of the amount of trouble to... You've got to find your scissors, chop up your coupon and fill it in, and every single one, because I've read them, have got a reason. And then you've got to find a stamp and an envelope and a postbox. Mm-hmm. How often do you do that nowadays?
Well, that's one way to change things, certainly. But I mean, coming back to this, the Portis headline, why is it that is still just, I think it's freight trains, am I right?
Yes.
Bringing imported cars and possibly taking cars for export as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
But no passenger service at all.
No.
Now, that would be used by commuters, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. I mean, this is one of the ridiculous things about, I mean, we totally support high-speed rail. But if the government only wants high-speed rail for wealthy people or whatever, which is very likely, and that's another reason we have to keep up the campaigns for these non-profitable branch lines and feeder lines. So Portishead is necessary to feed into London. Oh, yes, so it takes longer, more or less as long, from Portishead to Temple Meads as to go from Temple Meads to London. I mean, it's all part of the absurdity. I think it's partly also that North Somerset are very conservative. They don't understand that you need to spend public money for public services. They don't understand that the public sector is far more efficient than the private sector. They don't understand there's no reason for the austerity budgets. It's just a way of destroying the welfare state and bringing people to their knees.
Well, also, they're not very good at looking after their roads either, are they, in North Somerset? Potholes all over the place. I mean, I'm not saying our roads here in Bristol are perfect, but North Somerset seems to be falling to pieces. There's a complete lack of investment. Anyway, you mentioned high-speed rail there. We'll leave Portishead for the time being. High-speed rail... business case was ridiculed by the National Audit Office this week. This is David Millward and Christopher Hope in The Telegraph. The National Audit Office, which monitors government spending on behalf of MPs, has raised doubts over the viability of the 32.7 billion pound scheme to run 225 mile an hour trains on a 350 mile route from London to Leeds and Manchester via Birmingham. It's the latest blow to be suffered by the government over the project and comes within months of the High Court ordering the Department of Transport to rerun its consultation over compensation arrangements for around 300,000 households which will be blighted by the plans. Now, Judy, you say you're in favour of this. Mm-hmm. 300,000 households are going to be blighted by it. That is to say, they're going to have a train running down their back garden and are possibly going to want to move and demand to be compensated for losing the value of their property. Also, we've got existing lines. Why don't they just upgrade those existing lines? Why do we need a whole new train line, which anyway is not going to be on stream until something like 2020?
We do need the extra train lines because there's not enough capacity. almost the whole of Europe has high-speed lines. As for the cost, there are so many extra costs now, like consultants and so on. Fortunately, it will be under the state. It will be financed by the state. We think, because I've talked, because we, you know, I met today all the kind of key players in our campaign. We're at Stapleton Rose celebrating the new bridge built by Network Rail. And we just see this as a diversion. It's promoting the problems of the well-off people in Buckinghamshire.
To be fair to the National Audit Office, what they're saying is that in order to spend this money, a business case has to be established. You have to say, well, this is actually going to generate more tax for the country if we build this line. But Margaret Hodge MP, Chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, which considers the report as withering in her reaction, she said, the department has produced a business case that's clearly not up to scratch. Some of their assumptions are just ludicrous. Successive transport secretaries have argued the line will not only generate jobs but also rebalance the economy between north and south, but the report proves this is not the case.
This is
the National Audit Office basically saying that the figures have been massaged to make it look like this is going to be a great benefit to the economy, where actually all it's going to do is take a half an hour off of the journey time, that kind of thing. Mm. And that they're saying that actually, because people work on trains, this is another thing they're saying, it actually doesn't make any difference if there's a half an hour difference in the journey time. What they're trying to do is pretend that people don't. They sit on the train staring out of the window, but we know they don't. People can use their laptop on there.
I mean, there are two points. I just have to repeat that we do need the extra infrastructure. We need the extra rail.
Can't you stick an extra rail on the side of the existing one, for example? You're suggesting in Filton.
I'm not. Well, you mean that had happened in Filton?
Yeah.
I'm totally supporting the extra. I'm doing that because the rail unions all say that. The rail campaigners, our newsletter editor says that. So everybody who knows says it's absolutely essential. Okay. It's essential also for Avonmouth, improving its freight and so on. Now, the other aspect is this business case. Now, interestingly, business cases never take into account the environmental cost, the human cost of killing 3,000 people a year on the roads, what other? I'm sure there are lots of costs that are never... And it's more or less discredited. This old-fashioned business case is more or less discredited, and they're dragging it out, and I've got absolutely no confidence in what Margaret Hodge says, and I'm pleased to say that the shadow Labour rail person and the current Mr McLaughlin, whoever he is, which is the Tory incumbent, both say we still want this intercity HS2.
Okay, what about the line from, I mean, this is one of the oldest lines in the country, isn't it, from Temple Meads to London Paddington? There's a lot of criticism of First Group, the way they've run that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that is that nothing can be run for profit and for passengers. It's not possible. And I took part in that brilliant Worst Group, Worst Late Western, Fair Strike, and all that sort of thing. And it was funny, and it was brilliant, and it managed to get First Group some more money, I think, so they behaved a bit better. It's no point criticising First Group, it's the system. And I'm interested that you haven't asked about the fares. One of the reasons that our fares are at least twice what they are in Europe is because it's all run, well, for one thing, it's a great big mess. You know, it's all lots of different groups, different bus companies. And you do realise that Deutsche Bahn, a publicly owned German company, are running Arriva at the moment. And anybody who's interested in bringing the fares down should be supporting East Coast Mainline. Do you know what East Coast Mainline means?
Wasn't it a private company that failed?
And absolutely.
Now it's being run by the Department of Transport.
It's been run by the Department of Transport, directly operated rail, for the last 3 years. It makes £60 million profit a year. So what does the government want to do? Put it up for sale. Well, I'm really excited because a group set up in London with mainly people from all trade unions, not just the rail, and campaigning groups. And in the campaigning group is the woman who actually transformed the Severn Beach Line in 2006 with all her incredible, and she's in that, and she's set up a campaign called We Own It. And so what anybody is at all concerned about protecting and promoting our railway system must support the East Coast Main Line and say that must stay in the public sector as a start. And then I personally, I don't know anybody else says this, thank you, Richard Branson. You are wonderful. Because if it wasn't for Richard Branson, First Group would be running in a most enormous empire. I brought the map with me of the current First Group empire, which goes across, more or less across England. Now, you've got a bus company running, you know, right across England. Thank you, Richard Branson. Okay, you have wasted millions and millions and millions of our money, but at least we've got another 2 years to try and get into the public discourse, because basically we're not allowed to know anything. I mean, you know, I read The Guardian.
So what we're referring to here is the West Coast Main Line franchise.
I'm only as held. The sale must be challenged. And then we need to be building up. First Group and people will be putting in their bid by October. So we should, and thank goodness we got this group in London, country, will be challenging any franchise. And